Your window on the city.
Cambridge 105.
I quite like baked apples in the winter.
There's no fancy pants stuff in there. It's just proper English pork and it's lovely.
It's just a real sort of hubbub of stuff happening.
Do you remember I bought some chickens?
That's right.
That's when we started to sell eggs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's where it really started.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah.
Why did you become a butcher?
It was fun. I was at a friend's house once and I was helping her dad cut up a bit of venison. I didn't even know what I was doing, but I just knew I enjoyed it. Now I can do it properly.
We don't stint on the smoked salmon.
Well,
I don't.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour with Rosie Applin, Alan Alder and me, Matt Benman. Our thanks to Ian Dayborn for the last 2 hours of music, and now we head off on an hour of food and drink.
Today we bring you examples of some of the excellent ethnic food in Cambridge. We visit the Lebanese restaurant Lagona in Mill Road and go to the market for some traditional Valencian food.
And on a much more traditionally British note, we found out about blackberries and what you can eat them with. We also find out what Cambridge people's favourite summer fruit is. In addition, food photography. Is food after cats the most shared subject on social media? We get some tips on how to do it well.
And at the end of the programme, we'll be bringing you the Cambridge food and drink news, including, as usual, some jobs.
But first, Lebanon has a proud culinary tradition. Its Middle Eastern origins have been influenced by Turkish and French food. If you go there, don't be surprised to find croissants. Lagona. It's a restaurant Rosie has enjoyed, so she decided to find out more about it and the food it serves. And she spoke with owner Salah Eden.
As you know, Lebanese cuisine, we're not really using a lot of oil. We use olive oil, lemon juice, the herbs we use is healthy from the trees, etc. So we not really use a lot of fried. Even the meat we use a grill, I would say healthy food. Yeah.
And what would you say are the key features of Lebanese food? So what would you expect from a typical Lebanese meal?
A lot of mezes, a lot of starters, a lot. I would say not that heavy food. You could have vegetarian, you could have really mix of food. And yeah, I like to cook. And then when I started here, I thought, right, that's an opportunity to learn more about Lebanese.
Kind of eating with your eyes as well as your mouth.
Yeah, that's one of the things.
So I'm here today with Salah Eden and we're at Lagona on Mill Road. And you were telling me earlier that you were the manager of Aladdin, which was a restaurant on Hills Road, and that was more a mixture of Middle Eastern cuisines. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Well, we had that restaurant in Hills Road for 2.5 years and was a mix of Middle Eastern food. And that's the idea where you get Lagona from. So when we moved to Lagona, we thought, right, there's not Lebanese restaurant in Cambridge. So that's the really idea came from. And then here we are with the Lebanese food, Lebanese cuisine in Cambridge.
One of the things I noticed eating here was that you have incredibly fresh, vibrant ingredients. And I think you mentioned before that's quite important to Lebanese food. Was that one of the key things you wanted to do with Lagona?
Definitely, yeah. We think the food has to look really good, colourful before you actually try it. That's what makes you want to eat. You want to actually try that kind of food. So that's the key, I would say.
Lebanese cuisine was influenced by the different foreign civilizations that held power. From 1516 to 1918, the Ottoman Turks controlled Lebanon and introduced a variety of foods that have become staples in the Lebanese diet, such as cooking with lamb.
The lamb special is whole lamb. We use it for parties. Let's say a group of people, so that can take between 15 to 20 people, they could have that. It's very special because it's the way we actually cook it is differently, and it has to be marinated at least 24 hours.
It's a whole lamb, marinated in special herbs and spices, served with seasoned minced rice, vegetables and nuts. You'd need to pre-order this 2 days in advance of your reservation.
What would you recommend if you were going to give somebody an authentic Lebanese experience? What items from your menu would you recommend as really sort of authentic Lebanese dining?
Hummus, one of the common ones, I would say, really. Bazinjan al-Rahib is like a mix of salads. That's called starter.
Bazinjan al-Rahib, grilled aubergines served with tomato, onion, parsley and mint.
Kibbeh, like meatball, but slightly different as that meatball.
Deep-fried lamb meatballs mixed with a cracked wheat and filled with sautéed minced meat and onion.
This is a beautiful salad.
Yeah.
traditional Lebanese. It's a mix of pickles, turmeric, olive. That's very traditional, I would say.
Obviously, fettouche, that's what's standard, but I would say really Lebanese special salad. That's our special salad,
so
I would say.
What do you get in the Lebanese special salad?
You intend to tell you the secret of this.
The kind of things you might find without giving too much away. I know there's pomegranates in one of them.
Yeah, well, Patrice has a pomegranate, the other one has it as well. So because I could tell you the secret as well, because I'm a chef as well.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's 2 days a week I do it, so I know it's actually mixed up. There's other thing we use as well, we call it sumac. It's like a little bit of sour with a dry mint and olive oil, lemon juice, a little bit of salt.
Sumac is becoming quite popular, actually. I think a lot more supermarkets are selling it now. People are bringing it into their recipes. But yes, it's very delicious. I can vouch for that.
It's come from a tree. It's like a sour, spicy. Not that spicy. It's really different taste, but it's really sort of sour flavour.
It's a dried berry. As a spice, it has a light but tangy note. And there's roughly 250 species of sumac. Try substituting this in any dish in which you might squeeze fresh lemon juice, like grilled meat or fish, or you sprinkle it over hummus.
I have my brother. I think without him, I wouldn't be here. And I wouldn't be opening another business. That's closer for you guys. Yeah, so it's going to be next month, or the latest 1st of September. So it's going to be Laguna Bakery. It's going to be in Mill Road as well. Lebanese bakery is going to be. So a lot of fresh bread, a lot of baklawas, a lot of dessert.
Butter or cream is rarely used other than in a few desserts. When the French took control of Lebanon after the First World War, they introduced foods such as flan, a caramel custard dessert dating back to the 16th century, and croissants. And this isn't going to be your standard bakery.
Yeah. It's not going to be like common bakery, because we're bringing Lebanese bakery into Cambridge, because the bread's going to be fresh. As you know, Lebanese bread is slightly different. Another thing we're going to sell, our own product, our honey, olive oil, all mix of nuts, dry fruit as well. It's baked different way, different oven, and it's not very thick bread. It's very thin, roundy bread. It could be healthy, I say. Just the green deal and the way it's actually baked. That's the key, because the way we use in the oven is slightly different. Another thing as well, we're going to be importing our product. Olive oil is going to be from Lebanon. Honey is going to be from Lebanon as well. All mix of dry fruit will be from Lebanon as well. Obviously, we're going to be having a fresh baklava, fresh bread, and I can't say everything, so I have to keep a little bit of secret there. It's going to be our logo there as well, so it's going to be actually brought from Lebanon, specific to us. I think if that year wouldn't went well, we wouldn't go for another business. So that's the reason why we thought, right, let's go for something different. We tried to get something to Cambridge, something different, what's actually missing, what's actually not there. Let's go open bakery, that will add up something to Mayor Road, to Cambridge. And yeah, first year, it's been really good for us. Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome,
Megan. She's the smiley one. She always.
That's very important for a front of house.
But the bakery is going to be open from 8 to 5.
So if you wanted to have breakfast, could you come to the bakery and get like coffee and stuff?
Coffee, yeah. We're going to have coffee.
Oh, you have like a seating area? So people
can sit? Yeah, it's going to be sitting area inside. I think it's about 7-8 tables inside.
Okay.
And we have a garden as well.
Okay.
I can't say everything, so I have to keep a little bit of secret there.
And that's going to be quite a bit further down the other end of Mill Road, isn't it? So maybe by the time you walk from one to the other, you'll have worked up an appetite for a bit more.
That's for sure. That's for sure, yeah.
And yeah, now we don't need to go to London if we want Lebanese food. It's all here on Mill Road.
We brought you the Lebanese food into Cambridge. You're muscle.
Well, Salah, thanks so much for telling us about the secrets of Lebanese cooking and all about Laguna. And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Thank you very much, guys. A pleasure to have you here. That's one of the name, Laguna mean. It's mean till we meet again. That's our concern, I say.
Sounds like you had a good time, Rosie.
It was fantastic, yeah. Amazing food, and they really extended some fantastic hospitality as well. And something we didn't mention in that feature was some of the incredible teas that we tried after the meal. So we had a coconut truffle tea and a mint tea, and it was just, yeah, the whole experience was really fantastic.
Yeah, well, it sounded it. I shall have to go.
Definitely recommend it.
Changing the subject slightly, do either of you go and pick much wild fruit in Cambridge?
Not in Cambridge, but I did back in my farm days in Wales. We had wild blackberries, so I was always out there as a kid.
Oh, yeah, it's a bit of an Aplin family tradition to go slow picking on the Gogmagogs in the autumn times.
Oh, right, that's the place, is it? Right. Anyway, it's a really good time of year for picking wild fruit. It's particularly good. But if you follow Cab Davidson on Twitter, he's been finding a lot of good wild mushrooms. But I think that's something for the expert only. It's a really good year for plums, and you see the little red cherry plums and the yellow mirabelle all over the place in Cambridge at the moment. And on a walk just outside Cambridge last weekend, we saw lots of damsons too, some of which were already ripe. The shops and market stalls have some excellent local fruit too. And I stood at Chris's stall on the market and asked a few customers what fruits they liked, and also about blackberries, which lots of people, not only Matt, forage for.
Of those, that would be lovely.
Hi, I'm from Cambridge 105 Radio. We're asking people what their favourite summer fruit is.
Cherries.
What about blackberries?
Well, I like to sort of help myself. I'd never buy them, put them that way, you know, so I pick them because so many bushes are different.
And you enjoy them?
Yeah, because the cherries got such a short season, really, you know, and the blackberries, it's something when you go out for a walk.
Hi, can I ask you what your favourite fruit is?
My favourite fruit?
Your favourite summer fruit.
Summer fruits, okay, that's specific. I like peaches.
Do you ever eat blackberries?
I like blackberries, yeah.
What do you like about blackberries?
I like it because, like, sometimes it's really sweet, sometimes it's not, and it's a bit like lottery, it's quite fun.
Oh, plums, I suppose, that I'm buying them. I love plums.
Any particular variety?
Oh, I like it when the Victorias come out, yes, right. And there's nothing like them for making jam.
What about blackberries? Do you like blackberries?
Yes, but I like them with apple and other things in with them.
Yeah, yeah. Not by themselves.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
In the back, thank you.
Well, I would think raspberries. Raspberries.
Do you ever eat blackberries?
Yeah, usually with cereal in the morning, muesli or something.
Yeah.
That's it.
Thanks.
Oh, well, it's early rivers, but they're always gone.
Oh, the early rivers plums. And do you ever eat blackberries?
You do have blackberries, but we buy them. Favourite fruit? Cherries, I would say.
Yeah. And when you eat blackberries, do you eat them by themselves, or do you have them?
By themselves, generally.
Would you be able to tell us what your favourite fruit is, your favourite summer fruit?
Yes. Yeah. All fruit.
It's very, very healthy of you.
I don't know, cherries, peaches, strawberries, the usual, I guess.
Do you ever eat blackberries?
Eh?
Blackberries?
Yeah, sometimes I do, but normally if I go around just walking in the countryside, I just pick them.
Yeah.
I don't like cooked fruit, so I just eat them as they are.
Oh, I like plums. Plums and green gages.
Blackberries?
Yes. Yeah. With apples or on the own. Or make jam or jelly with them. I made some blackberry jelly the other day.
Some cherries, probably.
Donut peaches.
Oh, those are the flat ones.
Yes.
And what about blackberries? Do you ever eat blackberries?
Pick blackberries when we dog walk and stuff. Yes.
And do you eat them by themselves, or do you tend to have them with something?
No, I actually put them in a smoothie. So,
yeah, very
yes.
Nice. Thank you. So, cherries are a strong favourite in Cambridge, but I also asked the stall holder, Chris, himself. Yes, Chris, you're selling all this fruit. What's your favourite?
I don't think you can beat a Cambridge greengage. That's the best thing, I think.
And that's where these are from, is it?
Yeah.
What about blackberries? You haven't got any at the moment?
I haven't got any. I think the early ones tend to be quite sharp. I think the later autumn ones are much better.
So that's just a different variety?
Yeah, I think so. Wait for late September, they're much more mellow then.
Yeah. And when you eat blackberries, do you eat them by themselves, or did you have them with something?
No, I'd like to eat them by themselves. Unadulterated.
Right, a true aficionado.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. And that was Chris, whose stall on Cambridge Market is the one opposite Gap, but not the one on the corner. That's his is a couple of stalls further along the road.
So picking blackberries in the wild is, of course, very popular.
Yeah, it is very popular because I suppose it's so readily available. But what's interesting is there's more than 300 subspecies of blackberries. So you find from different bushes, there's different tastes and actually different amounts of seediness. If you find a good bush, don't tell anyone. Nikki Senyit, author of The Food Thesaurus, is a bit critical of the cultivated types. She says they're as tall as a beehive hairdo, bright as spit and polished toe caps, but they're not as varied in flavour as the wild type. They're pleasantly sweet, but never ever have the countervailing intensity of sharpness, mustiness and deep spice. And she talks about finding flavours of rose, mint, cedar and clove, and even tropical fruit in different bushes. So a great way to spend time on a hot summer's day is to collect from a few different bushes and see if you can taste the difference.
So are there any good food combinations involving blackberries?
Well, the most obvious, as some of those interviewees said, is with apple. And if you stew an apple with even just a few blackberries, the warm flavour you get is wonderful. And there's blackberry and apple pie or crumble too, though I think just the basic blackberry and apple is best because there's no distractions. And it's also wonderful to have it with porridge or muesli. Blackberries go well with vanilla ice cream or just with cream, though cookery writer Jane Grigson says in her fruit book that she prefers blackberries with milk rather than with cream. Nikki Senyit also recommends blackberry and goat's cheese and blackberries and white chocolate too, so a definite dairy connection with blackberries. Ever tried them with white chocolate?
No, never.
No.
Well, here in the studio, we have some blackberries and some white chocolate. So let's have a go and see what we think.
Okay.
This is very exciting. Thank you.
Right, so we're delving into the tubs of blackberries and...
Got chocolate in one hand.
Eating some blackberry in the other. Madagascan vanilla white chocolate. And
so this should offset the tang, right?
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it? The sound of eating on the radio must be awful.
I'm sure everyone's
loving
this.
Oh, I apologize for our noise.
It's delicious.
That really is, yeah.
It does go well, actually.
Yeah, I wouldn't have mixed that at all. That's brilliant.
Because
yeah,
these blackberries are quite tart. But, yeah.
It's really good.
The vanilla in the and the dairy in the white chocolate smooths it out beautifully.
Be nice in a cake.
You got any more?
I've got lots more. And the tartness that blackberries have is countered well by the alkaline nature of dairy products. And this is also found in Nigel Slater's blackberry and goat curd tart, which has cream as well as the goat curd to help. And by the way, for blackberry and apple, Jane Grigson points out that this was a favourite in Britain long before Bramley apples were introduced, which was in 1876. You imagine they've been here all the time, don't you? And before then, people used the windfalls of eating apples, which she actually prefers. And two tips from her are use round about twice the weight of apples as blackberries and include a small number of red unripened blackberries because this strengthens the flavour, which I don't think many people do. Now, a rather different combination I've come across is the mix of blackberries with mint and lime, which sounds really interesting. And Nigel Slater also recommends pork and blackberries. You gently crush blackberries into a rolled shoulder of pork, which you pierce with a skewer, wrap in cling film and leave overnight before roasting. Don't forget to take the cling film off. As with dairy, the creaminess of the pork goes well with the sharpness of the raspberries. And for the same reason, nuts are good too. Again, Nigel Slater has blackberry and hazelnut friands. And also, you find recipes combining with almonds. And they're probably worth trying with bananas too for this same sort of creamy reason. And finally, if you've run out of blackcurrants, blackberries make a nice substitute for a summer pudding, one of my favourites.
You're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105.
Coming up, what's new in store at Culinaris and food photography. But first, there's a new and popular seller of hot food on Cambridge Market. It's called Black Rice and it specialises in food from the Spanish region of Valencia, which is where paella comes from. Alan asked owner Joseph Pascal what he's selling.
I'm selling Valencian food and Spanish food as well, which is the paella. Right, we are selling four kinds of Valencian dishes. One which is the traditional Valencian paella. Today, for example, we are making one kind of paella with chicken and chorizo, Spanish chorizo, high quality. We are making as well seafood paella. And we are making as well fideuá, which is a dish with the same that the seafood, but with instead of rice, come with noodles.
Right.
Then we are making as well at the moment a spicy drunken chicken, meatballs as well, Nana's meatballs, which is a recipe that my grandmother gave to me. So you
what, all on one day? Or?
No. So it depends on the day. We are updating every single day in our Facebook, which is our menu. All right. So if somebody want to look what we are cooking, all right, they just need to go straight away for our Facebook and check what we are cooking today.
And what's distinctive about food from Valencia?
Well, if you go to Valencia, you will see that Valencia is surrounded the plant of the rice. So our diet is basically based on rice. So rice with everything. So chicken as well. People eat a lot of chicken as well. A lot of beef as well. So basically Mediterranean diet. So which is rice, extra virgin olive oil as well. A lot of vegetables. You make the paella, okay? In the last 2 minutes, the paella takes 20 minutes exactly. If you won't do that, the paella can it's not good. It's not good. All right. So the thing is, when you make the paella in the last 2 minutes, you have to put the fire as high as you can. In that way, what gonna make is in the bottom, you're gonna caramelize everything. So it has all the flavor of, it's amazing. So we call this thing socarrat in Valencia. There is no translation for English. There is no translation at all. So the socarrat when it's ready is black. And it's, well, it's black, it's like burnt, scorched. Scorched, well,
Okay, right. And for the one with the seafood, how do you get good quality seafood? Because in Spain, seafood is always really good quality, but not always in this country.
Well. I just got this guy who is here in the market
as well.
Yeah, who is giving me a really good quality. So you can see the difference between them.
Yeah.
You know, this one is a little bit more quality.
Right. Good. What's the most popular dish amongst the English, would you say?
Because
I know you have a variety of customers. I mean, I've seen some Spanish people coming today, but not just for the English people. Do they have
the most popular is two of them. It's the traditional Valencian paella and the traditional seafood paella. Both of them are really, really traditional. But the people here in England, as you know, love seafood. And the spicy drunken chicken is getting so, so popular, and the meatballs as well. A lot of people coming just to us for these dishes. Right.
So it sounds like it's going well.
Yeah, it's at the moment we cannot complain about nothing. We are really, really happy.
Good. And you're here from Monday till Thursday?
Yeah, Monday to Thursday. So we are Monday and Tuesday in the middle of the market
by
on the
fountain. Yeah.
All right. And we are Wednesday and Thursday, we are in this corridor, which is
by the Guildhall.
B and C. Yeah.
Are there any ingredients used in Spanish cooking that are hard to get in England?
Well, that I'm cooking normally in the paellas. The ingredient more difficult to get here in England is the bomba rice. Bomba rice is really, really high quality from Valencia. So there is not a lot of kilos to sell, you know. So about that, it's so.
How's that different from the sort of rice that we use?
The difference between bomba and one short grind is that the normal one takes, for example, double water when you cook them. Takes double water, and the bomba takes three times more water. So the first thing is that you have to know how to cook the bomba rice. If not, it's really difficult, you know. You can be wrong, you know, cooking. Then the second is extra virgin olive oil, coming from Spain as well. This one is it's in Spanish, but it's extra virgin olive oil from Verdú. I'm bringing from Spain, which is a dried pepper.
What are they?
Ñora. This is a dried pepper. it's just to give a flavor, a really good flavor, like a smoky flavor. It's really, really good. It's just for the seafood, this one.
Good. Okay, well, thank you very much. That's good. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks to Josep Cascal for black rice for that. And the care that's put into the market food really does impress me. Small providers really do go the extra mile to ensure their food is the best it can be.
And that music signals time again for the latest food tweets from the city.
Well, there haven't been very many this morning. Firstly, I have tweeted, though, to say there's plenty of cover for their beer garden, given that it's been raining and that hail is forecast. And Calverley's have tweeted as well, Calverley's in Hooper Street, to say that doing the food today is pizza mondo.
And time now for the latest in our somewhat irregular series called What's in Store. Now, yesterday, Alan went to Culinaris in Mill Road to find out from Rita what is new in the shop.
Rita, what interesting things have you got in Culinaris at the moment?
At the moment, we are really proud to host a few local products. We have a fresh organic milk that we are really proud of. It comes in glass bottles, just like the one that you can get delivered to your home. We have semi skimmed and whole milk as well. Also, we just picked up a new beef jerky from Biltong. It comes in three different flavors.
Right, can I have a look?
Sure. So it's basically an air-dried piece of beef, and we have three different flavors, garlic, pepper, and barbecue. And what I really like about this one, it's not as dry as other brands, so it's kind of a bit softer, and it tastes really nice, and it doesn't really have any nasty ingredients, so it's almost like all natural. We have a few types of local honeys that sell really well. People really seem to look for local products these days, so we have two types of honeys. Both of them come in seasonal flavors. So at the moment we have mixed wildflower and borage.
Oh, borage, yes. Borage. Well, I say borage, but that's only because of where I'm from. So while we're on this counter, you've got quite a nice jar of pine nuts as well. And they're quite expensive, aren't they, pine nuts usually?
They are really good quality pine nuts. So they come from this brand called Pariani. It's an Italian brand, and they only pick selected quality nuts. We not only have the pine nuts, but we have some other nuts from them as well, and all of them are really good qualities. Actually, one of our Hungarian brands uses the Pariani toasted hazelnuts to make some chocolate with it. So they cover it in a gingery chocolate, and they taste amazing. It's called Rozsaverdi. So it's called Rozsaverdi chocolate. And they have some chocolate bars as well with really pretty designs. And they only use selected ingredients.
Yeah, so they're good quality as well then.
Of course.
Right, okay. Any nice cheeses at the moment?
So we just picked up this new supplier. It has washed rind cheese and it has been washed in whiskey. It's from Streatham Cheese Company.
Right, so washed in whiskey. So that will permeate into the taste of the cheese itself, won't it?
Yes. Shouldn't we try it? It's pretty new. We just got it yesterday.
Oh, did you? Right. Some people are never sure whether they should eat the rind or not, but if it's a soft rind that's been washed in some...
It is a soft rind, and it's perfectly fine to eat, but sometimes we have a taleggio that can have a slightly thicker rind sometimes, and if you don't like the flavour, you don't have to eat it, but it's perfectly fine. Obviously, it gives some more flavour to the cheese, and it's always nice to eat like a whole piece of cheese from the inside out, so you get to experience the whole flavour profile of the cheese.
So if you work from the middle out, going towards the rind, then whatever the rind has been washed in becomes more noticeable as you get closer to it. I don't know many people who do that, so perhaps you should all do it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, it's lovely cheese, isn't it?
It is still quite fresh. What we like to do is when we get a new product, we try it, and you can feel the hint of the whiskey, I think, towards the end.
I think it's quite subtle, but yes, you can. Yeah.
And if we need to, we sometimes mature the cheeses ourselves until they become the perfect quality. We usually do it with our softer types, like the brie types of cheeses, because they can be really fresh when we get them from the producer, but after a few weeks they develop a really nice and creamy texture, which comes with a better flavour.
That's a very good idea. It must take quite a lot of space storing cheeses till they're ready.
Yes, but it's just a small price we have to pay for good quality.
Yes. Right, that's excellent. Any other interesting cheeses you've got?
We have this local pastrami as well.
Oh, right, ham, right.
It comes from Redmore Farm, and what's interesting about it, we work together with Ben from Redmore Farm, and he uses our ingredients, some peppers and some Hungarian paprika, to flavour this pastrami, so it is a really unique product in our shop.
Yes, and how long have you been selling that for?
Couple of months.
Yeah, and is it going well?
It is going really well. We used to have another type of pastrami, which was the third of the price, and we sell a lot more of this one because it's just such a good quality.
Even though it's three times more expensive.
Exactly.
Well, that's fantastic. It's not terribly expensive, is it? £3.50 for 100.
For 100 grams.
It's not
and it's really flavourful, so a little goes a long way.
Yeah. Oh, that's excellent. Okay. Thanks very much, Rita. Thank you
very much.
That was Alan talking with Rita at Culinaris in Mill Road, a fantastic shop.
Yeah, it is. And one of the things about it is how much they know about what they sell. They're really interested.
Well, last year, we ran a feature on food photography about four Cambridge-based photographers whose work you'll have seen on Twitter, on Instagram, and, of course, their own and their clients' websites. Some of these people are professional, some are semi-professional, and there's a devoted amateur, too. Now, I had a great time listening to their stories, their priorities, how they capture the mood of the cafes and the restaurants that we know and we love so well.
One of the big no-nos at restaurants is spending a lot of time taking a photo.
You're constantly seeing influences, even if it's subconsciously, they're there. Something just clicks in your head, you think that would look great with that or shot from there.
It was a very, very tight schedule, so we were like a boom, 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 boom. We did the shot a lot, you know, in one day.
It's the challenge of turning up somewhere and really not knowing what's going to happen. It's great for the brain, I think, to have that.
There's certain things that you have to be very, very quick, where, you know, it comes out of the kitchen, you've got a chef running across the restaurant, and people look at you thinking, this guy must be insane, he's just going to go and photograph. And then you stand up on a table in the middle of a restaurant to photograph something.
When I know it's right, it's like a click, bang, that's the shot.
This is a feature on four Cambridge-based photographers, a mixture of professional, semi-professional and amateur. You'll find their work in lots of local places. They take the photos that make us hungry.
My name is Ozzy Beck. I'm an amateur photographer. I started looking into photography about 15 years ago. That was when digital SLRs became affordable.
I mean, my first camera was a cheap DSLR, although it did film video, which my current one doesn't, which is annoying.
DSLR, digital single lens reflex. You can change the lenses, which will make a world of difference between shooting landscapes and food. There's zero delay between shots, and it can capture fast-moving images, like fast food. Oh, sorry, that next person was Mike Sim. Go ahead, Mike.
My name is Mike Sim, photographer. I work in Cambridge. I've worked with Pint Shop, Fitzbillies, Afternoon Teas, Novi, Steak & Honour, Gorilla Kitchen, Jalan Jalan. I think that's about it.
And this is Alessandra Sperani, an editorial photographer. She's done lots of work for magazines and books, and a lot of photography for Café Aromi, and there's three in the city now.
I don't see myself as a landscape photographer. Food awakens my interest and makes my juices going, as you would say. A photography course online and in the evenings. And then from there, I went from working 8 hours a day to 6 hour days. Then I started freelancing as a translator. And then I finally left translation to become a full-time photographer.
I'm Lucinda Price. 18 months ago, I gave up my office job and became a full-time photographer. I don't think I realised quite how brave I was until 6 months later, when I realised how much you needed to know to be a photographer.
I've really had a camera since ever I can remember.
You meet so many different people, you go to so many places and you do so many things that I genuinely believe I've got the dream job.
When I got into photography, I suppose, was about 10 years ago, and it was a real organic urge to learn. I've done it all through the wonders of the internet and YouTube.
Is the direction all entirely your own, or do you take direction from the clients?
Clients tend to have an idea of what they want, but I think I've developed a sort of specific style, which is what people come to me for. So I have a lot of control over what I shoot, I suppose, yeah.
My style, gosh, is so difficult because it's very minimal. You do need the right props. I don't like to clutter the pictures with spoons and forks and napkins and all that stuff. So I would say my style is very natural. I only use natural light, very simple. I hope it comes out as quite Mediterranean, as in colours.
I think if you want to find a category, for me it's more documentary. I like to take photos of the way things are as I find them, rather than manipulate them to make the image I want.
I like things at right angles. I like to either be like face on or shot from above.
If I was going to say I had a style, probably more towards the soft focus. To me, food photography makes me think of a really soft picture of a chocolate brownie with that big pointy corner of the triangle of it. And I think that's the essence to me of what food photography is that I always want to reach into the screen and take a bite out of this beautiful brownie.
I just don't care. If people say, you should really do it this way, and say, no, I'm doing it this way, the way I like it.
How would you describe your style?
So it's become slightly more organic, sort of saturated, quite structured. Symmetry is something I'm a big fan of as well, actually.
Because?
I think it looks nice in the picture. I shoot a lot of stuff from above to create more of a picture, so it not just becomes about the food, it becomes about the composition of the actual photograph as well.
So it's definitely a documentary for me rather than editorial.
Having said that, I don't believe that food photography is any different from any other branches of photography, because it's all about telling a story. It must be there, otherwise it's a meaningless image. Mm. And food photography nowadays tend to have a lot of context element, again, I guess, for the storytelling, because cookbooks nowadays have become so much more than simple cookbooks with recipes, because, you know, let's be honest, if you need a recipe, 9 times out of 10, you go online.
Really, in all of my photography, it comes back down to this click moment. It's the composition, when the thing is in the right place.
Yes, that is a very tricky balance to get right, because obviously you do want to develop your own voice, and that's what makes you stand out, and that what makes customers come to you.
If you have the photo of Uncle Albert falling off his bench, everyone will remember that.
Yeah.
And that's sort of my approach.
Fashion. Everything adheres to fashion, whether it's recording, photography, art, fashion. Everything is about fashion. And sure enough, they described how food photography was very utilitarian, I suppose, when it first started out. Everything was shot from above, and then it was described about how it then changed through maybe the 50s, 60s, 70s, how everything became about mood lighting and soft focusing and romanticising, I suppose.
Well, the 70s was horrible. If you see any magazine articles or cookbooks in the 70s, they look so unnatural.
I've got some books here.
Yeah.
A recent example.
Yeah.
And I guess one that's updated through the 70s, 80s and 90s.
Oh gosh, yeah, some real classic.
If we were to compare some of the images here, where you can very obviously date them, you say, okay, yeah, that's a style that comes from the 70s or the 80s,
yes,
and compared to these style shots, where there's a lot more in terms of very specific focusing.
Well, this is, as you said, very dated because of the light. I mean, this is all artificial lights, and you can tell, and you can tell how it shines here, and it looks a bit plasticky. Probably a lot of this food wouldn't be edible after they shot, because that was the trend. I mean, I wasn't around back then as a photographer, but that's how they would shoot.
And now there was a brief description of us being in a phase where it's much more about keeping it simple, rustic, clear and defined.
the Sunday Times magazine food area. I mean, to me, that just screams typical right now food photography. Quite rustic, you've got wooden spoons and you've got the whitewashed appearance around the food.
I have a portfolio with Stock Food, who is one of the biggest food agencies out there. And they do send every 4-6 months a newsletter with what they see as a future or current trends and requesting images they don't have in their archive. One requesting images of food presented in a messy way. As an example, they send a picture of an ice cream melting a little bit or a plate of pasta, not perfectly styled, but with a fork in it. So yeah, there was definitely an indication that is the current trend.
The styling with tree napkins and deliberately randomly arranged cutlery, and it's not a table, but it's sort of a distressed plank with flaky paint on it. I'm really not a fan of that.
Well, this is a good example of my style. Basically, I'm looking at a picture of octopus broth, is on my website, and the background, it's a panel of very old wood. The plate is a simple round plate. The composition is a look from the top, bang in the center, which sometimes people say, oh no, don't put anything in the center. It, you know, rules are there to be followed and broken, and is entirely up to you. I like it this time in the center. We must never forget that the food is the subject of the picture. Now I lost again what I was going to say. But,
and you'll be able to hear part two of that feature in our next episode.
Yeah, and Mike Sim is currently involved in the revamp and rebranding of the Cambridge Cookery School on Hills Road. So you can keep an eye on their website over the coming weeks to see his development there.
Hal Wilson co-founded the Cambridge Wine Merchants a quarter of a century ago. He featured in the first ever episode of Flavour a decade ago, so Matt thought it would be timely to get his thoughts on the last 10 years, which arguably have seen massive change in the local food and drink scene and seen him slay multiple Goliaths.
I quite like that, yeah. I mean, the kind of reason for being was because there weren't any independents left in the city centre, and now they're nothing but independents, which is great in terms of specialists. But as a company, we've done so much more since 2007 than we did beforehand. So it's, you know, it's where the action is.
It's funny, the only thing I remember about this place was it got attacked by somebody with a sword.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, this was back in around about 2000 and...
We haven't been attacked by a sword. We have lost a sword at a May ball. And very amusingly, it was probably about 2011 or 12, a picture turned up in the Times newspaper taken by a paparazzi hanging out outside Trinity of someone leaving with our sword. The committee managed to track down this guest and retrieve the sword. So sometimes you're grateful for paparazzi. Possibly this guest wasn't so lucky, but that's our sword story. But yeah, 10 years ago, this wasn't a Cambridge Wine Merchants. We had three shops at that time, but had only just moved into King's Parade. So this was a wine rack or thresher, part of that first Quench group. And so, yeah, 10 years ago, the business was very different, much smaller. We didn't have this wine bar concept because the law had only changed in about 2005, allowing on licenses and off licenses to sort of merge. This was the 2003 Licensing Act. So it was brand new territory to sort of sit down in a wine shop and have a glass of wine. In 2007, we were a third of the size we are today, at about 2 million turnover. We had three shops, and it was mainly retail. And today, we have three operating wine bars, one exclusive. It's part of the university centre. We've got four shops. We've got three franchised operations in different towns. And the business has got sort of group turnover over 7 million. So it's, in our sector of independent wine merchants, it's a big player.
It can't be underestimated enough just how much the change of a rule can completely revamp a business.
Mm. And it took quite a long time to work out what the ramifications could be or would be. Because the government at the time, you know, didn't really know what it would lead to. It had this idea that relaxation of licensing, you know, some licenses being later would actually allow for more of a cafe culture, more of a European style, less concentration of drinking in certain areas at certain times. So it was a kind of public health, but also allowing people to relax a bit more rather than concentrate their drinking. But this, I think this is a really lovely outcome of a bit of legislation, which was certainly secondary to the intention. I don't think the Secretary of State at the time, when he came up with the idea, he probably wasn't thinking of people hanging out in wine shops having a nice time. But it is a really nice place to enjoy good wines, good drinks, in a sort of ambiance where, you know, it's not sort of designed for one sector of the community or another. It's, you know, everyone's welcome. And it's been really nice to see the bar side of the business evolve and see people really enjoying themselves in our shops. Because retail can be a bit too transactional. You know, you have a chat with someone, they buy a bottle of wine, they leave. If you see them again, it's great. And you remember and you're there, you can ask them how their bottle of wine was. But here you see people enjoying their glass of wine. And you can ask them about it and see what they like and develop a relationship much more easily.
You know, I find myself becoming so nonchalant so quickly about these changes. Perhaps 14 years ago, this place would have been, as you said, purely transactional. People come in, they pick out their wines, they go. That's what people expected of a shop. Today, here we are sitting at the Cambridge Wine Merchants, and there's this whole culture here. You've got themed evenings, there's lots of wine fairs. Everything has sprouted around the traditional bottle of wine, I suppose. Mm.
And retailers have had to change. You know, we've had the internet over the last 10 years as well, so it's not just changes in legislation. Society has changed an awful lot. And people predicted the death of high street retail a long time ago. And some businesses like Threshers, you know, we're sitting in a shop that was a wine rack and that whole business is gone and it had 1,500 shops, it's, you know, and a lot of employees. These are big businesses, Woolworths, and another one was Oddbins in our sector. They just didn't have enough to offer to keep themselves in business in the face of competition from the internet and from big supermarket giants. So if you're going to be in retail, you've got to be a destination. You've got to make what you have to offer really interesting and exciting and enticing to people. Yes, we do all these things and we sell bottles of wine. And that's almost the afterthought because we spend so much time thinking about comedy nights and the music nights and the wine tastings and the gin club and the wine fairs and the exciting events that people want to come to, you know, the food park evenings and the steak and honour nights. You know, we started all of that and we had to come up with new ways of engaging with customers in order to stay relevant.
I keep picturing the David and Goliath fight. Here you were pre and post on licence and you were up against real juggernauts of companies there. As you say, they have all filtered away from Cambridge. You've survived them and proliferated since. Is it because you were much more malleable? I'm just wondering why they couldn't change in the same way that you did.
That's a really good question. I wasn't on the boards of any of those companies. So, you know, like you, I was just looking at what happened rather than necessarily having strong insight. But it was about eroding margins. Trying to just compete on price is something that you're going to really struggle to do with your overheads of, you know, very large and therefore expensive retail chain. You're trying to be a specialist. You're trying to offer something different. I think eventually, certainly at Oddbins, that sort of love for the business and what love for the industry and love for the product started to evaporate in the face of cold commercial realities. And Oddbins went through a number of changes of hands and really they just made more and more losses to, you know, whoever took over. And that was a fairly doomed scenario. The competition from supermarkets at the time, which I think is eroding a little bit, but you might remember 5-10 years ago, you'd walk into a supermarket and rather than seeing fresh veg, you'd see piles of Foster's cases at very low prices. And that's not doing much for the alcohol industry, just to see supermarkets using alcohol as a way to get people through the door and giving them loss leaders. It certainly doesn't leave the rest of the trade in a very sort of advantageous position. But I think those companies have grown up a little bit or changed their focus on what appeals to their customers and slightly more responsible way of going about their businesses. And we've done something just completely different. So works for them. We're trying to look at something completely 180 degrees away from it. And that's probably going to work for us.
I remember the government's initiative where they signed up Mary Portis to try and revitalise the high streets in so many dying towns. And she got it wrong. Whereas you were able to take advantage of all of the technologies that were coming on at the time. You know, you were in a city like Cambridge where things are relatively compact. but also snare onto Twitter and Instagram to get your customers aware of what's going on in an evening here, and they see the latest things that you've got in.
Yes, the food and drink community in Cambridge has really evolved as much more of a community-minded thing. You know, the street food movement, those are independent operators. Cambridge now has more independent wine merchants per head than any other city in the UK. So we are wine central and independent wine central. And where there were four Albins, now there are four Cambridge wine merchants. So feels that sometimes we're a bit cheek by jowl because it is quite a small place, but there's enough for everybody and we have different things to offer. And the supermarkets and Thresher never really had that ability to really enthuse, you know, from the heart about the wines they were selling. There's nobody in a Tesco's to really tell you anything about the wine range, which is fine. You know, there's plenty of information, and they lead on price, etc. You come to any Cambridge wine merchants, and hopefully you see people who know what they're selling, want to open a bottle in front of you and taste it with you, and put a smile on your face to take that bottle away. Yeah. That's always been a difference, and it's one that I think chimes more with people today than possibly 10 years ago. You know, if you want to buy something at the cheapest price, go online and buy it at the cheapest price. We still hope that the wine that you buy from us, you go online and you'll still buy it from us, you know, whether you're living in Cambridge or not. But if you really want to get to know the wine, you can't do that online, you can't do that in a supermarket, you can't really do it in anywhere other than specialist places where people know what they're selling. And it's not just wine, it's, you know, it's electronics, it's, I think the Apple stores are great for going to play. We want people to come and play with what we have to sell as well. We see it in those terms rather than just, we want to sell you something.
When I was here last time, it was for Estefania Lederamos's Spanish Wine and Tapas evening. It highlighted just how personal your selections are when it comes to wine. Alice was really enthusiastic about particular wine houses that Cambridge wine merchants had secured 75% of their product. And that was fantastic. And again, when I come here, I see wines that people, when I tell them, they're quite flabbergasted. You have that here? The Southern Spanish sherries, for example, from Sanlúcar de Barrameda. These are Spanish people telling me, my God, I didn't know you were able to seek these things out.
Yeah. Well, over the last 10 years, as I say, we've grown massively. We've tripled in size. And with that comes the wonderful ability to buy and in more volume and more things that you want to do. The UK wine industry is pretty tough on retailers. There's a very high duty. We're not really a big producing nation, so you've got to ship wine from quite a long way. But that's the way to actually survive, is to try and get relationships with really good producers and ship from them. And if you can do it exclusively, you can make a real noise about the fact that you have this wonderful wine. Decanter magazine, the main consumer magazine for people who like wine, they have panel tasting, so they look at a different region. They had a panel tasting for grower champagne. Champagne made by people who grow the grapes and make the wines themselves, rather than the bigger négociants like Mordenchan or Veuve Clicquot, etc., who are buying grapes from the growers to make the wine. So just grower champagnes, but from a really large and interesting field of 100 wines. The one that we import, we've loved for 10 years, came out head and shoulders above everything else, with a score of 98, and we've sold thousands of bottles, thanks to Decanter for... But all the judges loved it the best. The price was right. It's nice to have validation of what we already knew and what our customers, who've been buying it for years, know. We're very passionate about fortified wines, one of the best ranges in the country. And Martin Skelton, who's the managing director of Gonzales Bias in the UK, and Gonzales Bias is the biggest sherry producer, he was saying that Cambridge Wine Merchants has been partly responsible for the recovery of sherry in the UK. So it's really touching and wonderful to be linked in good news stories like that for areas which are absolutely great, great quality. But you need to have immerse yourself a little bit in the different styles of sherry so you'll become more confident in a wine merchant. So it's great to be part of making markets or revitalizing areas of the world where everyone knows they make great wine, but actually getting people to fall in love with them again is, you know, that's... So it's a lovely story. We've done that with the south of France as well, which is Vineyard and Garden of France, you know, the largest vineyard area in the world, but not very big in the UK. But it's our biggest area of sales, and it's our enthusiasm and our wine buyers' expertise and our restaurant customers who've sort of said, you know, these are great, we can buy everything we want from one area. So all of the Cam's Cuisine restaurants, which, you know, chop houses, they've moved all their list to south and southwest France, and that's kind of just revitalized that area and made a real market in the UK. Another great illustration of how we go about buying also ties in with a story that's just been broken yesterday in a sort of leading diabetes magazine. The Danish Public Institute of Health had been looking at frequency of drinking mainly wine and relating that to reduction of risk developing diabetes. They looked at 70,000 subjects. It was proven that, as we probably all know, moderate and regular drinking of red wine proved to cause the least risk of developing diabetes. So I think we can all drink to that, if not too regularly and too often. But I think the government guidelines are about right. It's sort of 3 to 4 days a week drinking 2 glasses of wine. Anything above that may or may not put you at greater risk. And of all the wines in all the world, they looked at what some of the properties were that were good for both for diabetes but also lowering the risk of heart disease. The grape variety that has the highest sort of antioxidants in the skins of the grapes is a grape variety called Tannat. Of all the Tannats in all the world, where it really comes from and where the concentration is the highest is in this area called Madiron, which is where this wine comes from. And this wine, we don't go out looking for high antioxidant wines. We go out looking for delicious wines that we think are good value. But this is a wine that we discovered last year, and we've been importing exclusively to the UK, working with these great wine growers down in Madiron. And this is their entry-level wine, but it's for a really quality wine. Mm-hmm. And Madiron used to be known as the most expensive wines in France. Been overtaken by the wines of Bordeaux and Burgundy. Yes. But 150 years ago, before the phylloxera outbreak, the wines of Madiron, the black wines, were noted to be the most expensive and the finest wines in France. So this is fine wine, but not really at high prices. And this is $12.99, absolutely ripe. It's intense, it's got these lovely sort of dried fruits, slightly caramelized, and a bit of cocoa, as well as this kind of cassis. So this is the Tannat grape, really doing its thing. It's good for you, by all accounts, and a really delicious drink with full body and smooth tannins. Yes, and I think people can, you know, people are coming back to France and Spain and European countries to find this style of wine. Hearty British food, hearty Southwest France wine. I think we've got this in a couple of restaurants, and the wines from Cayor, which are made from Malbec. So Malbec's very well known. We all think it's from Argentina, but you know, the real heartland where it came from is the Southwest of France. And it's sort of dropped out of favour in Bordeaux, but has always had its heart in this town called Cayor. And Madiron, like Cayor, has got its own grape variety. So this is Tannat, which is the main grape variety of that area.
And I got the chance to try some of that Madiron wine, and it really was gorgeous stuff. I think it quite possibly the best red wine I've had. Really beautiful, and so nice to know that there you have something of such a fine heritage at such a really, really reasonable price. It's definitely worth a try.
And many thanks to Hal Wilson, Managing Director of the Cambridge Wine Merchants.
On now to the food and drink news for Cambridge. And there's some big news this week, but let's start as usual with jobs.
Afternoon Teas in King Street is looking for a part-time barista, about 25 hours a week, including some weekend work. Starting date is the end of August, but the cafe is closed from the 14th to the 25th of August, so if you want to talk to them about it, do so soon.
The Orchard Tea Garden in Grantchester wants full-time and part-time staff, serving, in the kitchen and washing up. You can inquire at the counter, and Arjuna in Mill Road is looking for a full-time member to join their team. Get an application form from the till.
The big news items now. A couple of new foodie places are opening in Cambridge. On Monday at 11 a.m, Dolcido Patisserie opens at 60 Hills Road with well-known and highly regarded pastry chef Andrew Hunter. So that's pretty exciting news, and we wish them best of luck.
And as you heard earlier on Flavour, Lagona is opening a bakery and shop next door but one to Bacchanalia on Mill Road. That's pretty exciting too.
And if that's not enough, Rosie Sykes has taken delivery of her new book, due out in October. It's called The Sunday Night Book and is full of short recipes to make the weekend feel longer, and I can't wait to see it.
If you're in the market for some really tasty lamb, Mill Road Butchers has got some salt marsh lamb this weekend.
Yeah, very nice is salt marsh lamb. The next Mill Road Feast is the 20th of August in the Gwydra Street car park, and that's from 11 till 4 p.m.
In case you somehow missed it, the Cambridge News Food and Drink Awards are announced on Thursday. Our congratulations to the winners, who include The Larder at Burwash Manor, who won in the farm shop slash deli section, Millworks for restaurant, Stem and Glory for Best Newcomer, Wandering Yak for Street Food, Stir for Coffee Shop, and Itihas for Takeaway.
Coming up at Trumpington Allotments, also on the 20th of August, is a family fun day. It will include allotments and community orchard tours, various demonstrations including composting and a scarecrow competition. More details of that in our next programme.
There's a three-day cocktail weekend at the Corn Exchange over August Bank Holiday, the 25th through the 27th of August. There are many bars, the street food from Nana Mexico and Warm and Toasty, as well as music, free cocktail masterclasses and workshops. Go to the Cambridge Cocktail Weekends for details and how to book.
And finally, the Waterman Pub in Chesterton Road at Mitcham's Corner has just reopened. With craft beers and ciders and a kitchen, it looks like somewhere we might just have to give a try.
And that's all we have time for today. If you missed bits or just want to hear the whole thing all over again, the podcast early next week.
Remember, you can email us, flavour@cambridge105.fm, or follow us on Twitter, @flavour105. And of course, you can follow Cambridge 105 Radio, @Cambridge105.
But that's all from us. We'll be back on the 19th of August. But until then,
goodbye.
Bye.